Reading from The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser, Chapter the 10th. So here's the map of the Caribbean, that great blue beautiful sea bounded to west and south by Mexico and Latin America, and to north and east by the curving island chain of Cuba, Hispaniola, and the Antilles. Focus on a point where the Isthmus of Panama snakes down to join South America at what is now Colombia, and the map dissolves into a sweeping aerial night shot of huge purple hills and dark emerald jungle, fringed by a strand that gleams silver under the moon. And brightest of all is the spot where old Castile has stretched out its stately hand and placed the jewel that is Cartagena, that glittering citadel of the most famous seacoast in all romance, the Spanish Main. Churches and palaces lie white under the night sky, their glory mirrored in the dark sea at the city's feet, its lights twinkling like a carpet of fireflies through the dusk. You can almost hear Ravel's Bolero swelling to its great crescendo when those spine-tingling trumpets blare suddenly from ambush, and then the music throbs away into silence. That was Cartagena of the old days, when Spain held and plundered the New World from California to the Amazon, while the heretic fleas of England, France, and Holland clung almost unregarded to their tiny footholds round the edges of the great sea, and none dare challenge the vast empire of His Catholic Majesty, with its great garrisons and galleons, its fortresses and harbors, its far-flung cities and mines and provinces, and plantations and their armies of slaves, and priests and settlers and soldiers, its unlimited wealth and power and glory. None, that is, except a lawless company of bare-legged hunters, woodcutters, renegade seamen, gentlemen, fugitives and scoundrels. One or two of them would write books some day, and win their little fame as explorers and naturalists and historians, and one would even become Archbishop of York, and roar for pipes and rum in the vestry. But mostly they were plain ruffians, and in the time when they hit and ran and harried the Spanish giant by land and sea with their tall ships and long guns, they were called by a name detested in the Escurial, disowned by nervous governments, idolized by their Protestant countrymen, and patronized by history. Buccaneer. So much for the record, and to explain why, as we look down on that tropic fairyland in the summer night, Garda Costa sloops scuttle to and fro among the palm-fringed coast like water beetles, and massive cannon peer from battlements above the anchorages. For no honest Spaniard knows when, out of the blue north, may come those terrible towering ships, flying their Union Jacks or Jolly Rogers, and bearing crews of even more terrible men who growl in the tongues of the North and Channel seas and lust for the blood and treasure and women of New Spain. But on this night, all was tranquillity, and the Garda Costa crews snoozed sweatily at their posts, or munched tacos and tortillas and garlic sandwiches, while they listened to the strains of Carmen Carmela strummed on mandolins. They didn't see the great galleon which came dipping in after nightfall to anchor out beyond the roads, but if they had, they might have recognized her as the Santa Cascara from far Cadiz. It would have been too dark to see the hideous crossed-out scrawl on her stern, which now read Goland Van Titty. Nor had the Garda Costas bothered to patrol beyond Isla Baru, not that they would have detected in a gloomy mangrove-screened inlet the rakish silhouette of the lean black cruiser known to the filibusters of Cayona as the Sac de Terre qui rit, or Laughing Sandbag to you. Aye, 'Twas dread black Bilbo on the prowl in the Don's very backyard, you see, lurking most frightsome unseen, for you'll mind he and Sheba intended to venture incognito into Cartagena, there to learn the sailing date of the viceroy's fiancée from Spain. Little did they guess, the Santa Cascara had sailed several weeks ahead of time, trust the Goa reminder to get it wrong, and was now at anchor only a few miles away, with Donna Mellifluo reclining in her cabin, being fanned by McDaniel, and tapping crimson lip what time she schemed, all innocent-eyed, how best to get her girlish hooks into the marvellous Avery, the designing hussy, and her only 16. Meanwhile, the object of her passion is up on deck, wondering how to convey her discreetly to Don Lardo, for you can't just breeze in on a viceroy, even a Dago one, with, "Hello, Lardo, old man, I'm Avery, discredited naval hero and English heretic, and I've got your intended out yonder on my ship. Well, your ship, actually, everyone had their own, but I had to sort of requisition her with bloodsome slaughter." Not good enough. Bound to raise awkward questions, to say nothing of trouble with customs and quarantine. No, better scout ahead first. A similar problem had faced Bilbo and Sheba earlier that day, but they'd had longer to think about it. As a result, a remarkable entourage had entered Cartagena's Barranquilla Gate at the hour of siesta, led by a stately gentleman, brave in black and silver, with plumed castor and long beribboned cane, his modish cordovan boots squeaking something fearful. At his heels stumped a perspiring dwarf, who shaded his master with a multicolored golf brolly, and gasped sotto voce, "Not so bleedin' fast, Cap'n! A screw in me wooden legs come adrift!" They had paused at a joiner's shop in the plaza to have the leg roll plugged, and let the townsfolk have a good gape at the rest of the procession, which consisted of a score of slaves staggering under matching luggage, and a sumptuous mule litter guarded by an enormous red-bearded goon and containing a mind-boggling beauty of dusky hue. Clad in a leopard-skin tracksuit and picture hat, with diamonds dripping from her shapely wrists, she had reclined languidly, yawning while a maid silvered her toenails, and demanding in a bored voice of the stately gentleman when the hell they were going to get to the goddamn hotel, and if there wasn't a sunken bath, she would throw up. She had paid for the dwarf's leg repair with a jewel tossed to the joiner by her maid, and the entourage had passed on. All of which had created a sensation, reported within the hour to Don Lardo himself. The viceroy's eyes narrowed in thought as he listened to his chamberlain's breathless account. "She's the Countess Passionata Eclair, fabulously wealthy widow of the President of Plantation Slaves and Human Cattle, Inc., making a tour of her late husband's estates, and Excellency, believe me, she is the original cherry blossom bimbo, but stacked. When she moves, it is like a boa constrictor struggling to get out of a wetsuit. Her eyes are smoldering coals of desire. Strange scenes lurk in her velvet elbows." "Enough," lisped Don Lardo, lowering jaundiced eyelids. "Command her to my masked ball and knee up this evening, and if she is less than you describe," he stifled a yawn, "I may have you impaled on stakes of burning bamboo." "Save your matches, boss," chortled the chamberlain. "This little number is truly tall, tanned, and terrific, por Dios." So now we come to the grand ball and knees-up scene, where a brilliant throng of cavaliers and ladies in costly finery tread elegant measures neath the glittering chandeliers of Don Lardo's state apartment, to the music of Xavier Cugat and his orchestra playing rum and Coca-Cola. At the buffets, groaning with crystal and gold plate, other guests punish the choice viands and sweet wines of Peru, among them the stately gentleman in black and silver, whom we recognize as Bilbo, is having the time of his life among the anchovy canapes and stuffed olives, for this, to Bilbo, is gracious living as he always dreamed it would be, with lackeys proffering goodies and brimming his glass, bold-eyed beauties of quality ogling his raffish elegance through their masks, hidalgos exchanging bows with him and calling him esteemed señor, and to complete his bliss he has discarded those damned boots for elegant diamond-buckled shoes, and his full-bottomed hairpiece is glued down with airfix, when a ravishing duchess murmurs huskily, "Shake me, handsome." He whirls her into the conga line, the while his crafty eyes stray to the viceroy's dais to see how Sheba is doing with Spain's answer to Billy Bunter. Sheba is finding it distinctly rough, magnificent in a silver Marie Antoinette wig, with matching mask and off-the-shoulder catsuit in clinging lamé. The sable villainess has never been more bewitching, and the pasty-faced ape lounging with her on the vice-regal sofa, his piggy eyes devouring her, has whispered no fewer than 4 highly indecent proposals into her dusky ear in the past 2 minutes. Sheba, smiling evilly through the slits of her mask, responded in her husky murmur with counter-suggestions of such obscenity that the little greaser's corpulence quivered with delight, and clouds of steam rose from his lace collar, wilting his fine suit of purple taffetas, in the worst possible taste, naturally. He humped his obesity still closer, and in a lustful croak invited her to come upstairs and view his collection of Aztec pettipoint. "You fascinating, wicked boy," purred Sheba. "How can you tease a poor girl when all the world knows you are to be married to the most beautiful lady of Spain? The lucky little beast," she added, flashing splendid teeth, "I could scratch her eyes out." "That isn't for ages yet," panted the portly lecher. "Ah, Passionata, my ebony dove, my cocoa bean." "Not for ages," said Sheba, as she nibbled at her fingers. "Why, when does she sail from Spain?" "Ah, that is a state secret," he leered, munching at her wrist. "Anyway, who the hell cares? Let you and me go shake the universe, baby." "But I don't know," crooned Sheba, moving her elbow out of his jaws. "How can I rearrange my schedule so that I stay as long as possible in Cartagena with you, you mad wild boar, you?" "Schedule, schmedule," crowed the rotund amorist. "We'll talk about it tomorrow. Ah, your shoulder tastes divine. Come to my love nest on the second floor, Passionata." "Aztec pettipoint, here I come," thought Sheba with an inward shudder. Well, she'd better tip Bilbo the wink that this was going to be an overnight job. "First, take me in your arms for a quick whirl round the floor, foolish Hercules," she husked, sensuously disengaging her neck from the vice-regal teeth, and with a glad cry the taffeta-clad Lothario dragged her into the dance, where they gyrated to the intoxicating rhythm of the Inquisition twist, the latest dance craze from the old country. But who's the splendid figure standing at gaze in the doorway of the vast apartment, elegant in long-skirted coat of crimson camlet with ruby buttons, his half-cut features clean concealed, his clean-cut features half-concealed by a silken mask? The very picture of a Spanish grandee, and he's got the papers to prove it, if necessary. He holds by the hand a diminutive stripling lad, equally masked and modish, who hangs back in cheesed-off reluctance, Let's eavesdrop on their whispered converse. Grandee, thus far have I conveyed thee in disguise, willful mellifluous, at no small risk to myself, so I think you might stand up straight and not droop in fashion unmaidenly. Stripling,
how can I be maidenly in drag? And I do not wish to be conveyed me. Capitan Ben, how can you be so cruel? Since I met you and lay in your arms and felt your kisses on my lips.
Grandee, no such thing. You kissed me, and I thought it was out of innocent gratitude. Mellifluous,
and lost my girlish art. How can I contemplate any other man, least of all that jitter-bugging jelly Don Lardo? Look at him. He is vile, fat Yogi, and he quivers most disgusting.
Grandee, austere he's not, yet kindly heart may beat neath exterior o'blubber and purple taffeta. Anyway, old girl, he's your parents' choice, and you can't ask fairer than that.
Stripling, pathetically,
I can ask for the man I love, the handsome, noble, yummy, cruel Capitan Ben who spurns me.
Grandee, oh, come off it, I don't.
Stripling,
you do spurn.
Grandee, oh, mellifluous, we've been through all that, and it boots not, honestly. Your juvenile passion for me, though natural, will pass like measles or acne. And be a sport. Thou knowest my affections are bestowed otherwhere.
Stripling, gnashing.
Ah, the endemonized vanity! You shall never have her! If I denounce you now, cry out that here is no grandee of Spain, but an heretic English pirate.
Grandee, I'll pretend I didn't hear that, because I know you'd never do anything so mouldy. I'm trusting you to give me time to get clear before you make yourself known to old Lardo. Just wait here after I've gone, and when he's finished dancing with that tall black lady in the silver combinations, you can—
As he spoke, Avery glanced at the lady in question, saw her clearly for the first time, and ended his sentence with a sharp cloing. Where had he seen that queenly chassis before, that feline assembly of whistle-bait? One hand clutched his brow, the other dropped to a rapier hilt, and then, as she swung, he saw the glittering diamond cross about her neck, and with a curt, "Hold it right there, half-pint," to the astonished mellifluous, he stepped smartly to the side of a flashing-eyed hidalgo who was hanging about spare, bowed with courteous flourish, murmured invitation in fluent Castilian, and borne her in among the dancers, the better to get next to that sinuous silver shape that had driven all other considerations from his mind. Sheba, grinding effortlessly to the music, was noting with interest that Don Lardo was obviously a dance freak. The panting viceroy, wig askew and eyes agog, was jiving it up a storm, his little fat legs going like pistons. "Groove down!" he cried as he shook revoltingly. "Let it all hang out!" Sheba trucked elegantly clear of his clammy paws as she looked about for Bilbo, and found herself face to face with a cavalier in crimson whose mask seemed riveted feverishly on hers. She gasped. That chin, those magnificent shoulders, that style, those very earlobes that shrieked class. "You!" she hissed, faltering as she twisted.
"On the contrary," said a metallic voice which turned her ankles to jelly. "You!" A steely arm which thrilled her by its very touch encircled her waist and swept her like thistledown into the crowd of dancers. Don Lardo's plaintive cry of, "Where'd she go?" sounding in her ears. Then she was frugging as in a dream with this crimson stranger, his eyes gleaming through his mask like iced tonic.
"You came after me?"
Her voice trembled with wonder.
"Like Nemesis, not Cupid," was the grim retort. "So we'll have that diamond cross for starters, or I shall inform the Viceroy who is the black velvet Venus who dances masked at his ball."
"Rash fool," hissed Sheba over her shoulder as they freaked out back to back. "Betray me and ye blow the whistle on yourself. Spain has a long score to settle with Captain Avery of the Navy."
"Here is no Avery," said he, turning to peck either side of her sleek head. "None knows my face, and at need I have papers shall prove me Don Espresso, captain of the Santa Cascara. Try that on for size."
"The Santa Cascara?" Sheba's head swam. "Why, 'tis the Argosy shall bring Donna Melliflua from Spain. But she sails not for weeks. When we shall—"
"Aha!" Avery sank and rose again in elbow-swinging triumph. "So your foul brotherhood proposed evil to the Argosy and that tender lady. Too late, Duchess. She has sailed. I have her, and Donna Melliflua lies under my protection." To regain her composure, Sheba executed a torrid limbo routine, and when she came up again, her voice shook with emotion.
"Oh, Long Ben Avery, if this be true, ye are even better than I thought. Sworn enemy, ye may count yourself. But congratulations."
"Thanks," Avery sombered modestly round her, but his voice was rock-hard as ever. "Natheless, I'll have that cross, and be sure thy doom shall follow another day, at my more leisure." He clasped her close, and they cut a torrid rug the length of the ballroom, and back through the frenzied throng. Sheba, her emotions ravished, not only by shock, but by his presence, found herself slipping the diamond from about her neck. Strutting, she twirled it on its chain, her amber eyes fixed on Avery.
"Ye swear not to discover me to the dons for the nonce."
"Is that wet? Is that dry?" asked Avery, rattling off a quick tap routine, and as he ended in the hoofer's classic lunge, the diamond cross smacked into his palm. With a grim smile, he trousered it. "Wisely conceded, Black Sheba. 'Tis but the first trick in the game I play against thee and thy carrion kin." The dance was a gas, by the way. A pity your last measure shall be trod neath the gibbet. So, adieu. He dropped a finger on her head. She whirled automatically, and when she looked again, he was gone, leaving her limp.
Cospetto, what a man! To have frustrated her Donna Melliflua caper before it even hatched. To have traced her here, and bearded her in the Viceroy's very palace. Ay, and won back from her the Madagascar Jewjaw. And how he danced! And he had chosen to bargain with her rather than turn her in. Was it possible that some tenderness for her lurked beneath that frigid public school frontage? Nay, it must be. And if not, she would yet awake it somehow, somewhere. But here was Don Lardo coming to claim her. At least she didn't have to butter up the little creep any longer, now that the Melliflua kidnapping was up the spout. Sufficient for her to extract herself in safety, she must warn Bilbo and Firebeard, who lurked somewhere without, guarding the sedan chair.
"Aha!" cried Don Lardo roguishly. "Who eth a teething little temptress? You play hard to get, my Pathionata, but I have you at last. One more cha-cha, and then I carry you to paradise on the second floor. Keep the show moving, Cugat!"
And as the orchestra let fly again, he whirled Sheba into the dance with wild cries. Avery, having quitted the floor, was pausing to compose his racing thoughts. If Sheba was here, could the other villains be far away? First things first, he must return to the disguised Melliflua and coax her into revealing herself to Don Lardo, while he, Avery, retired discreetly and took order. He glanced towards the great doorway and saw, to his consternation, that it was entirely devoid of mellifluous, disguised or otherwise. This was what he had feared, and why he had insisted on bringing her as close to Don Lardo as possible. The tempestuous young Snurp had slipped her cable rather than be delivered up to her odious fiancé. Well, he couldn't blame her, but what now? Chin in hand, his shapely calves taut in testimony to his mental tension, our young skipper mounted the marble steps to a secluded veranda giving on to the palace garden, there to plot his next move. With a sigh, he decided that Mellifluous was now beyond his scope. He discharged his responsibility by bringing her to Cartagena. As for the Brotherhood, he would keep a weather eye open, and if none of them seemed to be out, he would retire with all speed and secrecy to the Santa Cascara, lying beyond the roads, and seek them elsewhere. A muffled yelp reached his keen ears as he paced the veranda, which was screened from the dance floor below by boscage, rummage, and plant pots. The yelp came from an alcove a little way along and was followed by a plaintive voice which was strangely familiar. "Get them off, damned mannikin," it said. "My feet burn, my bunions are like to burst. 'Twas the conga that did it, and odds bobs, hammer and tongs, my toupee is coming unstuck. Pull, rotty, thou halfling nit, pull, I say." All Avery's gentlemanly instincts surfaced at these sounds, betokening some cavalier in distress. He turned the corner, and there was a splendid figure in black and silver, sprawled on a marble bench, while a red-faced dwarf tried to remove its shoes. For Bilbo's elegant evening footwear had turned traitor at last, and his dogs were barking in protest. Goliath was making heavy weather of de-shoeing him, and Avery, never suspecting who the masked grandee might be, stepped forward and offered to help. Old ladies with heavy baskets, stray cats, maidens threatened by dragons, or chaps with sore feet, it was all one to Rover Scout Avery, reared in the Grota Job tradition. Bilbo, seeing only a blasted interfering mask exquisite in crimson, bit back a blistering oath and answered as politely as his anguished corns allowed. "I thank you, signor. We shall do very well. My cursed shoon, you see, but I would not trouble you." This in his best Spanish. "Pull, you puny little bastard," he added to Goliath in English, and Avery started. "You are English, sir?"
"Nay, nay," cried Bilbo, appalled at almost giving himself away to this damned don. "But this handless lout, my valet, you see, is an English slave, and I address him accordingly."
"Ah," said Avery, "permit me then." And with two quick flicks, he had removed the constricting shoes.
"Pooh! Gosh! I think," he added, stepping back hastily, some cold water, embrocation, and bags of camphor should meet your need, sir. As to your wig—" "There's nothing wrong with my wig," cried Bilbo, clutching at it. "I mean, signor," he added with an ingratiating grin, "that I would give you no further trouble. I am much indebted, sir. I am now very well. I would not detain you, your servant, sir." He bowed from his seat, massaging his toes.
"I understand, signor," said Avery politely. "Yet if, as I apprehend, your wig will not stay in place—"
"It stays in place admirably, signor," cried Bilbo, adjusting it feverishly and getting it all askew. "'Tis in perfect nick. I thank you. Pray give it no thought, I beg. And so good evening to you, sir."
"I was about to advise," added Avery helpfully, "that wigs adhered by gums and goos and such like are wont to come adrift in the heat, and stout strings looped about the ears were better security."
"Oh, bugger off, nosy!" shouted Bilbo, his temper exploding. "My wig is no business of thine. Split me!"
Too late. He checked on the English words. Too late, remembered the part he was trying to play. Instinctively his hand swept to his hilt, and Avery's eyes, following it, widened at the sight of the great black pearl and golden cross glittering in the pommel.
Like lightning he twitched aside Bilbo's mask, even as the buccaneer came to his unshod feet. "Bilbo!" The captain's voice cracked like a fractured walnut, and he swept off his own mask to let the villain see what he was up against. For a split second they stared, and then the two blades leaped from their scabbards, and Goliath, with a squeal of, "Don't hit me, I'm too small!" hopped behind a plant pot, even as the razorish steel grated and rang along the veranda. Rash, you think? Precipitate on both sides? Absolutely. The pair of them going off at half-cock like that in a place where both were impostors and liable to have to do some awkward explaining. Aye, but when two such as Black Bilbo and Long Ben Avery cross swords, d'ye see, then sense and reason take wing wi' Ilwanian, and naught's to matter save the bright eyes and whirling point of the adversary. There wasn't an instant to draw breath or spit a curse, like, "Ha, villain!" or "Government Ponce!" or mess about with the furniture, for this is world-title stuff. From prime to octave, high lines and low, with imbroccata, staccata, allongé, and all that jazz, the two lithe figures shuffling, gliding, and lunging with what looks like a bright buzzsaw flickering and clashing between them, too fast for the eye to follow. Any bets on the outcome? Bilbo's fantastically good, and has the advantage of stockinged feet, which not only affords it better grip, but makes Avery keep his distance. Avery, on the other hand, is a genius, as we know, and younger and fitter. But then again, Bilbo has the experience, and knows a lot of tricks. But curiously enough, black scoundrel though he is, the thought of using them never crosses his mind. He's enjoying himself too much, as he feels that electric impulse that surges from body to body along the grating steel to warn him that this time he's fighting for his life and must fence as he's never fenced before. Along the veranda they went, their shadows fighting along the wall beside them like huge, grotesque seconds. Michael Curtiz would have loved it. Avery coming within an inch of victory as his point slashed through Bilbo's coat, Bilbo countering with a whirling thrust that Avery only kept from his throat by turning the blade with his left hand. And now came uproar and feminine shrieks from the ballroom, hurrying feet as the dancers suspended their revels in alarm as the sounds of combat reached them, while through the garden little Goliath hopped as fast as his timber leg would permit, looking for Firebeard, which was a waste of time since the big ape had got thirsty, found a side door to the palace cellar, and was now lying prone in a puddle of yellow chartreuse, singing One-Eyed Riley, though sadly off-key. Goliath, finding the sedan chair unattended, wasted 5 minutes tracking him down, and another 5 minutes in futile first aid and blasphemy over the sodden giant. Let's leave him to it and back to the ballroom. It was scatter and scream among the dancers as the two figures, black and crimson, fought their way down the steps from the veranda and across the tessellated floor, neither sparing a thought for his surroundings, Bilbo grinning like Rathbone and perspiring in rascally fashion, Avery grim and gorgeous and apparently dusted with talc. The orchestra searched frantically for a Max Steiner score as the blades and feet of the fencers whirled and stamped ever faster. Caballeros gasped and senoritas squeaked, every eye on the flashing swords and none wider than those behind Black Sheba's mask, save perchance those of the pale-faced modish stripling who peeped out anxiously from behind a pillar at the back. No, Mellifluo hadn't absconded very far, not yet. This is the way it should be. Two of our hero's female admirers watching distraught as he fights for his life. Yes, it was lip-chewing, bosom-heaving, finger-twisting time for the two of them, while the blades rang and the watching crowd gave vent to courtly Castilian exclamations like, 5-2, the crimson, and show us your muscles, and who told you two bums you could fence? And none applauded more vociferously than the portly viceroy, which puzzled Sheba, for surely he should have been calling the cops to stop this brawling in his personal ballroom. Something fishy here, thought the pirate queen, but even as some instinct prompted her to flee,
Dunlardo's pudgy paw seized her wrist, and he was leering at her vindictively, piggy triumph in his chewed toffee eyes.
"Going somewhere, baby? But it's just getting to the exciting bit, eh? Stay on, my passionata, or should I say, come back, little Sheba."
Rumbled, thought Sheba, and with a desperate warning cry of, "Bing avast, Bilbo!" she sunk her teeth in Dunlardo's arm. He tasted rotten, like a very old Portuguese hot water bottle, and his yowl brought scarlet-clad guards who had Sheba pinioned in no time. But Bilbo, hearing her cry, which is cant for run for it, acted like quicksilver. Deftly turning an avery lunge, he bolted at speed for the nearest exit, only to find a dozen guards, rapiers drawn, in his path. With a cry of, "West Ham for the cup!" Bilbo launched himself at them like a tiger, pinking a couple before they grappled him, fell with exultant cries on his stockinged feet, and tickled him into submission before dragging him helpless to where Dunlardo was rubbing his fat paws and gloating over the captive Sheba.
"So," he cackled, "what have we here? The famous Captain Bilbo and the delectable Captain Sheba of the Coast Brotherhood, eh? Fools, did you think to go unrecognized? Donna Passionata Eclair and her cavalier escort?"
He snapped his fat fingers, jeering. "I knew you from the first, English pirate scum. I lured you here and played cat and mouse with you because I'm smart, me, and now you are in my power.
Are you trying to steal my thunder again, worm?" lisped an icily musical voice,
and a deadly hush fell as the gay throng, with squeaks of apprehension, gave way, bowing and scraping before the most terrifying creature Avery had ever seen in his life. Through the parting courtiers he advanced, a huge and utterly repulsive figure, all the worse for being dressed in the height of fashion, scarlet satin from unspeakable head to misshapen foot. Fatter and even more yellow than Dunlardo, his face would have made Guy the Gorilla look like Mr. Universe. It was all there, flabby jowls, bulging lips, squashed beak of a nose, and pale red-rimmed gooseberry eyes, which seemed to gleam with a crazy light. He even had yellow fang-like dentures, which slipped out from time to time, to be retrieved and replaced by one of the swarm of lackeys who followed him, bearing a great red throne. He lurched forward, leaning his enormous gaudy bulk on a scarlet cane, and his free hand played with a live black widow spider, raising and lowering it on its thread like a hairy-legged yo-yo. A right charmer, in fact, looming monstrously over the scene, glaring at the helpless Dunlardo, who cringed and dropped to his knees as the liquidly musical voice issued again from those blubbery lips.
"As I recall," lisped the newcomer, "'twas I who recognized the description of these pirate vermin and instructed you to impersonate me for their benefit, to find out their criminal designs. Right, enchilada?"
"Sure, boss. Mercy, boss,"
babbled the purple taffeta fatso, and shrieked as the scarlet ogre swung the Black Widow menacingly in his direction.
"Not the spider, boss, please."
"What makes you think my spider would go near you, you detestable excrescence?"
lisped the other, pale eyes fiendishly aglitter.
"No, if you displease me by letting our little charade go to your head, you lured them here, indeed. I shall have you impaled on burning bamboo after all, and listen to you sizzling in your own fat."
He lowered his great bulk under the throne, and the dreadful eyes rolled at the prisoners. Suddenly the deadly, sibilant voice rose to a scream.
"Why aren't you groveling? I want to see them crawl!"
Enchilada scrambled, quaking, to his feet.
"On your knees, heretic pigs," he squealed. "Abase yourselves before His Excellency Dunlardo Barluna del Lobby y Corridor.
Viceroy of the Indies!"
And Sheba and Bilbo were thrust prostrate before the throne.
"Well, here's a turn-up, and if it's a surprise to you, picture the astonishment of our principals, especially the disguised Mellifluous, peeping horror-struck from behind her pillar at the back. This nightmare creature was the real Viceroy, the man she was to marry?" Her senses performed a terrified side-stroke. Why, this was a grade-A tarantula, and obviously barmy to boot. The fat little chamberlain who'd been posing as Don Lardo was almost attractive by comparison. A greasy, lustful little podge, admittedly, but sane at least, and she could always have shut her eyes and thought of Aragon. But this hideous fruitcake, oh, parents dear, she moaned, how could you? Sheba, crouched at the tyrant's feet, was reaching the same conclusion. No melting sundae herself, she felt a nameless dread as the real Don Lardo's mad, evil eyes slithered over her. Cruelties and vices undreamed of lurked in their empty depths, and she shuddered as he reached down a huge hairy hand to fondle her shoulder. "'Tis the most exquisite jungle bunny," hissed the viceroy. "No wonder you slobbered over her, enchilada, but you shan't have her. Oh, no, I shall enjoy her exclusively, and afterwards have her racked to pieces. Unless," he added with a hideous chuckle, "I decide to combine the two operations. What better accompaniment to lovemaking than her screams of agony and snapping bones?" He laughed crazily, and the courtiers squirmed uneasily and muttered that it was a great idea, and why hadn't they thought of it? The viceroy's staring eyes raked them and stopped suddenly at Captain Avery, who was still standing, sword in hand, where Bilbo had left him. "Who's he?" cried Dunlardo, glaring at Enchilada. "I don't know him. Is he another endemonized foreigner? Why isn't he groveling Borghios?" Now, you or I would have been frozen witless, but not our Ben. With courtly grace, he sheathed his rapier, made a leg, shot his cuffs, composed his eyebrows with urbanity, and strode gracefully forward, tripping only slightly over the prostrate Bilbo. With a flourish, he drew a document from his breast pocket. "Permit me, Excellency," said he, and the fluency of his Spanish would have done credit to a coffee commercial. "I am Don Espresso Banana, commander of His Catholic Majesty's ship Santa Cascara, which lies presently beyond the roads. My credentials." Cries of astonishment rose from the crowd as Enchilada, at a nod from Don Lardo, took the document and scanned it. "These are luncheon vouchers from the Escurial Cafeteria," he cried in bewilderment. "What?" bawled Don Lardo, goggling. Avery frowned in vexation. "My mistake," he said, and pulled papers from another pocket. Enchilada took them.
"Why, Excellency," he yipped, "it's a fact. This is indeed Don Espresso, and he brings your Excellency's noble and ravishing child-bride, Donna Mellifluous, from Spain. But, Signor," he added as the crowd gasped at this sensational news, "we didn't expect you for weekses."
Avery made a gesture of elegant deprecation. "What would you? The lady was so eager that we sailed ahead of time." He bowed tactfully to Don Lardo. "Who could blame her?"
"But of course,"
Don Lardo grinned wolfishly, shuddered with delight, and gave Enchilada a brutal belt over the ear.
"Wasn't it obvious, animal? She couldn't wait, the avid little cupcake. They never can. Caramba, but I've got the message for the birds, me."
Sycophantic cries of agreement came from the courtiers, while the lackeys replaced Don Lardo's gnashers, which had fallen out again in his excitement.
"But where is she, then, the fortunate Chiquita?"
he demanded eagerly, and Donna Mellifluous gave a stifled moan of terror and shrank behind her pillar. Avery sighed. "Alas, Excellency, she is a trifle fatigued from the voyage, and begs your indulgence that she remain aboard tonight. I was hasting to announce our arrival when I recognized this desperado,"
he boldly indicated Bilbo, and engaged him immediately as duty demanded. Pray accept him, he bowed over the prostrate buccaneer, with my compliments. By Jove, he can think on his feet, can Avery. He had been ready, as we know, to deliver the reluctant Mellifluo to her betrothed, but now that he's seen Dunlardo in close-up, he's realized that it just isn't on. This ghastly gargoyle, playing with his beastly tarantula and looking like Boris Karloff after an unsuccessful facelift, simply won't do. A bounder without taste, and not the full hod of bricks, either. Certainly not a fit mate for a sweet senorita, whatever Mummy and Daddy may think. No, Avery has decided that he'll have to find her again and get her out of this monster's clutches somehow, but for the moment he must stall for time and hope that his borrowed clothes and Castilian accent continue to pass muster, which they would have done but for one thing. Bilbo, held face down before the viceroy's throne, and keenly conscious of his position, was shot if he was going to let Avery get away with this. He writhed in his captor's grip and prepared to bawl denunciation. "Odd's blood!" he shouted. "Thou king's pimp, do you think we'll go down the drain without taking you with us? I'll learn you to cross swords with me and make personal remarks about my wig. Shalt share our fate. Hear me, Dagos, this Dawn Espresso is—" "Mum, Bilbo," cried Sheba, "shut your scuttle." And as much from amaze as in obedience to the Brotherhood Code, Bilbo cheesed it, while Dunlardo went ape. "They're talking!" he frothed, clenching his enormous fists and rolling his goose-gog eyes in frenzy. "They're not grovelling in abject violence! It's unbelievable! Why doesn't someone tear out their tongues, or sew up their lips with red-hot needles, or tell them to shut up? I can't stand it! Take them hence! Chain them in dungeon dank and deep! Notify the Inquisition! Take their names, ranks, and numbers!" He flung his enormous scarlet body about on his throne, ghastly features suffused, dabbing at his emerging dentures with flimsy kerchief. A sure sign, this, in any 17th-century villain, of approaching apoplexy. And at Enchilada's urgent chivying, the two pirates were dragged hastily out, Black Sheba darting Avery a smoldering glance in which entreaty, warning, concern, passion, perplexity, and come hither were admirably blended. The gross Dunlardo, who had squashed his spider in his rage, was fanned into tranquillity by his attendants, who replaced his teeth and gave him a new black widow, which he yo-yoed breathlessly. "God, I knew it was going to be one of those days," he hissed breathlessly. "Where was I?" His pale, empty eyes blinked redly at Avery. "Ah, yes, Don Espresso. So my little bride wishes to rest. No doubt she is apprehensive about meeting my own standard of perfection." He leered horribly, beckoning Avery with a finger like a hairy cucumber. "Tell me, as hombre to hombre, is she as worthy of my bed as her portrait promises?" "Dashed bad form, as well as being one of those tricky, have-you-stopped-beating-your-wife questions," thought Avery. He answered guardedly, lest he provoke this nutcase to frenzy, whether of jealousy or enthusiasm. "'Tis not for me to say, gracious excellency," quoth he smoothly, "yet did I remark rather the lady's beauty of character and perfection of nature, her delicacy and taste."
"You mean she enjoyed the floggings and keel-haulings on your voyage?"
cried Dunlardo, his ghastly map alight with hellish animation.
"Oh, goody! A consort after my own heart!"
He yo-yoed the Black Widow up and down, licking his dreadful lips. "I think," he lisped, "that I shall give her an auto da fe as a wedding present. Ah, the crisp fragrance of relapsos burning at the stake! She will adore it! I can't wait to meet her!" Little Enchilada, nodding greasily at his master's elbow, murmured, "Then you won't be needing that chocolate cookie, Sheba, will you, Excellency? Don't worry, I've arranged to have her disposed of." "One more peep out of you,"
lisped Dunlardo icily, "and it'll be burning bamboo time, remember. Which reminds me, in the morning I shall preside at the interrogation of the rogue Bilbo. He shall tell me where lieth his ship, and any other snippet of information about his pirate brethren that we can wring from him. Thereafter, what's left of him can be turned over to the Inquisition. The Black Tomato," he went on with a mad cackle, "shall afford me amorous sport before she goes the same way. Then a quick shave and shampoo, and I'll be all set to receive Donna Mellifluwa, when you, Don Espresso," his mad pale eyes glinted in Avery's direction, "bring her ashore tomorrow night. Until then, you remain here as my guest. See to it, Enchilada, and the rest of you. On with the dance!" He waved a huge scarlet arm, and as he was borne out on his throne, yo-yoing his spider and laughing crazily, the band struck up Viva España. The courtiers abandoned themselves again to the heady Latin measure, or crowded round the buffets for a quick blast. Dunlardo's appearances invariably sent the alcohol consumption rocketing. Enchilada handed back the luncheon vouchers which Avery had presented by mistake. Our hero nonchalantly retrieved Black Bilbo's fallen rapier from the guards. That's 2 bits of the Madagascar crown he's got now. Donna Mellifluwa continued to hide behind her pillar. Sheba and Bilbo were chained up by their brutal jailers in the loathsome gloom of dungeons far beneath the palace, and in the wine cellar Goliath the dwarf gave up his attempts at artificial respiration on the sozzled Firebeard, and feeling like a drink himself, mooched among the casks of Amontillado and Fiesta Burgundy in the hope of finding a bottle of Bass. There wasn't any. "Guzzling dago gits," observed Goliath moodily, and with a sigh, got stuck into the yellow chartreuse. "Just another typical night at the Viceregal Palace, Cartagena, and it isn't over yet. Avery's got problems. Will his disguise be pierced? Can he rescue Donna Mellifluwa before tomorrow night? Will his guest room be away from traffic noise and the laundry chute? Why doesn't the loony monster Dunlardo consult a decent dentist? It's all very distracting, and liable to play havoc with the schedule of our hero's campaign against the Brotherhood. At this rate, it'll be weeks before he gets back to Vanity, who, he fondly supposes, has been picked up from Aves by Vladimir Mackintosh Grunbaum. We know better. Or do we? Where is Vanity by this time? For it's 37 long sea pages since we last saw her, helpless in the grasp of the lovesick happy Dan Pugh. Whither has he borne her? And what's the score? And how is Blood doing? And that with a curse, eh? Just a minute while we scour the oceans for a sight of that vessel of ill omen, the Frantic Frog.